This is the October 15th, 2018 climate change law class. We're starting recording early, so there are some announcements that will be capturing the audio this time. So if you're jogging listening to this, my apologies. Only one announcement of events coming up, but only because it's time sensitive. Any of you are interested in going to the Houston Bar Association Environmental Luncheon, which is this Wednesday. It starts at 11:30. Charles Irvine is talking about post-Harvey litigation, and you need a ride. Let me know. I'm going to have to take my car to that lunch, so I'm glad to give folks a ride if they want to, if they'll just meet me in my office, and I'll be heading over there probably around 11:20 or so. So give me a heads up or an email, and I'll be glad to give you a ride. And I guarantee you we'll be right back here the instant the lunch is over, because I'll have to get ready for this class. Any announcements you guys want to bring to everyone's attention at this point? All clear? All cool? Okay, then I just can't resist pointing out a couple of news items. How many of you watched President Trump's interview with Leslie Stahl? I'm just curious as to your reaction, since you are in the midst of taking this class, how you'd respond if someone told you President Trump said what he said on there. Did anyone miss that by a chance? Are we all up to Chris, since you saw it, could you just give us a quick distillation of the flavor of that fascinating interview?
So on the note of climate change, he kind of said, he said in a sort of like offhanded way that he like usually does, like, oh, I think the climate's changing, but I don't know if humans are doing it, and it could be changing in various ways. It's always changing things. Yeah. His usual sort of like all over the place.
That was scarily verbatim, actually.
Yeah.
Although he then said, and it could also change back.
Yeah.
Which was thought was interesting. The other things President Trump said, and this is not a political discussion, I just think for legal assessment of strategy and future regulatory action, we need to know this. President Trump also said that he didn't know, so when Leslie Stahl pressed to say, well, what about the report from the UN that came out from the majority of climatologists saying that it's conclusive that there's a link between human activity and climate change, his response was, I'll have to see it, and a lot of these scientists have agendas and political agendas, so I would have to read it myself. The only other thing I'm aware of, and Chris, you may have seen more of this than I have, is Leslie Stahl then pressed him, well, if I were to take you with me and to see the icebergs calving off of Greenland, what do you tell the scientists who are working there? And his response was, well, I have no idea if those icebergs would have calved anyway, even if mankind was not involved. And the whole exchange took about 90 seconds. That was the extent of the pressing on the issue. But it is probably the most comprehensive thing President Trump has said since taking office about climate change. And it's a significant reformulation, because as we know, before taking office, he had said climate change was a Chinese hoax. In a Twitter, I want to be fair, this is not a policy statement, but nonetheless, I find myself at a bit of a pause on how to respond to that. I think what I would suggest, rather than us spend a lot of time on it today, is just think about how you would respond if someone said to you exactly that, and especially if it was, for example, a client. Or if it was someone that you thought that you had to make an argument to as a decider in a regulatory agency or a judge. I mean, you guys have had the benefit of talking to the climatologist of the state of Texas and reading the science and seeing the state of play right now. Just wanted to give you a chance to sort of think about that, because responding to those issues is timely. I will confess to you, I dropped entirely in prior versions of this class, cultural cognition and how to deal with people who had difficulty believing in climate change science. And I put it back in. You guys are the beneficiaries of that, because I think it actually has become something that's important for a practitioner these days. So that was the one thing. The second thing as well was, again, in the same spirit, how many of you saw Senator Rubio's response to Hurricane Michael's damage in Florida? Again, just same point. His response was, yes, it was damaging. Yes, the hurricane's terrible. Yes, climate's changing. Yes, humans are affecting it. I have no idea to what degree. So that seems to be the current reformulation of political constituencies who are reluctant, I think is probably the better word for it, to put full credence in climate science at this point, as formulated by the IPCC. All right, so just news items. I just felt compelled to tell you those two things. I'm not sure they qualify as legal, but I just was, if you had anything else you had to say in response to that, we find ourselves on the front pages in ways that I never would have predicted 2 years ago. So anything you guys like to say to that before we dive into the meat of the class today? Chris?
I found it interesting. I think this is generally seems to be sort of Trump's kind of understanding how economy should function, but he often he seems to talk about climate change in a way that's almost like, I don't know if he actually believes what he's saying. It seems to be that it's a lot of it's sort of like this developmentalist kind of mentality where it's like, oh well, you know, carbon taxes or whatever seem to reduce the growth that he seems to want to exist, like manufacturing, and so we don't want to consider that because we're just going straight ahead with, you know, sort of like increasing our GDP or like reducing unemployment. And I think later on in the interview something else came up where it was like I think it was talking about like reducing arms sales to the Saudis, and his response was, oh well, I don't want to put people out of work at Boeing or Raytheon.
Yeah.
So I think that also fits into that, where he just seems to be quite focused on that.
No, that's an important point which I missed entirely. The other comment Trump made in response to Stahl was, I don't want to give trillions and trillions of dollars, and I don't want to lose millions and millions of jobs by dealing with climate change. So that I think, in fairness, that is clearly behind the curtain of some of his thinking on some of these issues right now. Okay, so with that, news items related to our class, things I want to talk about. Number one, I have to apologize. The class recording for Jennifer Barks's guest lecture last Wednesday is a lovely recording of the empty room across the hallway for an hour and a half. So I've talked briefly with Jennifer, but I haven't had a chance to get feedback as to how the class went, what sorts of things you covered, and if you had any questions now since you've gotten back. It's sort of our last lap on climate litigation before we move on to international law today. Just briefly, so what sort of things did she cover with you guys? That's great. You get to review for me this time.
We went through the cases more thoroughly, I think. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's how she tackled the litigation and climate change. And I thought it was interesting because it was more of a conversation, I feel. I mean, she definitely, you know, engaged with us, but it was more of a roundtable discussion of the case.
That's great. So I assume the original federal cases and then the state law cases.
And then we spoke a little bit about the children versus the U.S. that's coming up and how that looks for the future. What would it mean if it went to Supreme Court and different
things? What was her takeaway, out of curiosity?
I mean, she said, if we just talk about how, regardless of how it, what the court decides, or likely go to the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. So it's just interesting to see how this case finally going to reach, I mean, might reach litigation, and how it seems to be the issue withstanding and everything that all climate change cases have had seems to be very highlighted in this case because the U.S. is really trying to avoid litigation at all costs.
They filed their third mandamus motion this week, trying to get the case dismissed, which I thought was fascinating. And we can talk about that in just a second. So it sounds like then you covered the same cases in general, but in more detail on the ones we talked about, which hopefully gave you a chance to ask her some hard questions and how they actually work, because she's probably in a position to tell you the litigation mechanics of them. So given that, any surprises from what she told you? All right, no surprises, okay.
I'm sure there was some, I'm just trying to recall.
Okay. Well, one other thing is I probably am going to call Jennifer up later, maybe not this week, next week, and just ask her if she had one thing she wanted to include in the final exam, what it would be. So if you had anything you'd like me to steer her towards, give me a heads up about that. My sense is that what she told me was that she tremendously enjoyed teaching the class. She said it was an enormous amount of fun for her. So, if you, given the feedback here, I'm inclined to invite her back again. All right? Okay. The second thing, in addition then, beyond talking about Jennifer, is I also wanted to give an update on her topic, which is, this is so hot off the press, I haven't even had a chance to read it yet, but this is the latest decision in the Giuliana case. There's just been a 69-page opinion handed down, which basically has, let's put it this way, they're still going to trial in 2 weeks. I'll put this up on the website, we can talk about it later in the semester. But if I could, I'll just point out a couple of quick things. Number one, the United States won an argument. The judge has dismissed the president from the lawsuit. It's just regulatory agencies now. Second, the request by the government for more time to identify witnesses and to seek mandamus to postpone the trial has been rejected, in part because the court has judicially noticed, that the United States has already admitted to the existence of climate change in its response to the complaint. It's already admitted that human activities contribute to or cause climate change, and has admitted that those activities and climate change will cause damage to the children plaintiffs. So it's an interesting contrast, which is why I want to start with our comments from our president at the start of class. So anyway, in 2 weeks that trial starts, assuming the mandamus motions get denied again. And I will be curious to see how it goes, and we will certainly keep track of it as it goes. My sense, I haven't checked the scheduling order, but that trial's going to at least last a couple of weeks. All right? Okay, so with that, last chance. Now it's open table. Any questions about climate litigation before we turn to international law? If a partner walked into your office and said, I need you to handle this climate litigation case, you feel like you have everything you need to know to be able to jump on the assignment? Okay. All right. Well, then with that, I'm literally turning the page. Today, we move beyond to what's really sort of the latter part of the class, which is we're no longer going to be focusing on domestic law. We'll be looking at international law and how it applies to climate change. So as a place to start with that, we need to talk about what international law is, where it comes from, and how it's enforced. So with that in mind, I want to just, I think I asked you all this previously, if you could bear with me and just refresh my mind. How many of you have had international law before? You two?
I think classes related to international law.
Like what?
I took comparative law, and then I also took, wasn't called war criminal law, I'm trying to remember what it was called. It was like ICC type law,
international
criminal law, that's it.
Yeah. Oh, wait, Professor Past?
Professor Hall.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm in a class now that we're reading Past's book.
Oh, really? Which one?
Yeah, it's the little writing course. It's called International Conflicts. We study like terrorism and war, and that's what we write our papers on.
Oh, wow. Is this Professor Berman's class then?
No, it's Fote.
Okay. Wow. Okay. Well, then this is great. Usually when I teach this class, I'm starting with a completely blank slate where no one's had any exposure to international law before. So what I'd like, I'm not going to call on you, but if I could conscript you to just jump in, clarify, offer thoughts, respond as we go along, I'd much appreciate it. For those of you who haven't had international law, the object today is to get everyone up to the same page. What I want to do is get over basic concepts so that we all understand how the mechanics of it work. Open the door a little bit to how those existing international obligation systems work and the way that they apply to climate change, and set the stage for us to get into a deeper dive on the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, Kyoto, and build up to the Paris Accords, which we'll wrap up by Monday of next week. And then the idea is that will give you the tools you need on Wednesday to represent your respective nation states in negotiating a rule book for implementation of the Paris agreements. Okay? All right, so with that in mind, I'm going to start with the most embarrassingly basic but toughest question. What is international law? What are the hallmarks of it that distinguish it from all the laws we've been studying for the past 8 weeks?
So the majority of it is customary, which is not, of course it's treaty law and it's written somewhere in the international context, but a lot of it is just became custom through the recognition of the states
Okay, so that is how, what is the substance of international law? I'm asking a more fundamental question, which is, what is the quality of international law that makes it different than domestic laws? I mean, think about, what is domestic law in the first place? How do we get domestic laws?
It's when like a sovereign nation state, they have every sovereign nation state will have its legal system and they'll have their own sort of codified or common law, or I guess civil laws, or the legal state that exists within like nation states, whereas international law kind of transcends boundaries and has maybe uncertain relationships with the hierarchies of like nation states. So it's like there's not like a supreme international court.
Exactly. And I think you've got to the heart of the chase right there. It's a beautiful comparative law answer, by the way, because you didn't immediately cut to the chase, which I tend to do, looking to the United States as the template, but it's really not the case. Domestic law all shares common qualities that you guys have captured. Namely, it is a binding framework implemented by a centralized authority, which applies to everybody whether or not they consent. Would y'all agree with that formula? I know it doesn't have the elegance of the jurisprudential answer, but I think it's a good functional answer. Now, think about that in the context of international law. The truth is, we do not have that mechanism, do we? Now, we can talk about that in a little bit. Maybe there are some parallels. But the fundamental starting point for any international system is the irreducible fact of sovereignty. Nations have a sovereign right to determine their own fate within their own borders. And that essentially means that laws of states have to be designed in the circumstance where you do not have necessarily a compulsory mechanism to compel states to take action in a format that's similar to what we'd see in a domestic format. So carry that through. Think about what the implications of that are. It means, who does international law apply to?
Whoever decides it applies to themselves in a way, I guess. It's like, theoretically, if a nation state wanted to violate international law, it could do so without repercussion if it hadn't signed some sort of treaty which carried some sort of weight. Like, for instance, if your nation's like already signed on to Geneva and you break the Geneva Protocol, then that's a violation of international law. And if you also, I guess that then you'd have to be signed on to the National Criminal Court. But if you sign on to the National Criminal Court and give them jurisdiction, then you might be liable to be.
Well, you mean the International Criminal Court?
Yes, the International Criminal
Court. Okay. Absolutely. So, but carry that through again. I mean, essentially, if, say, for example, let's say a good nation state that's a rogue. Say North Korea decided that they were going to hack your bank account because you posted a defamatory cartoon of the Supreme Leader. And they drained every single cent you had. And it was a violation of international norms for them to do so. What's your remedy?
Yeah, there's no mechanism to.
Why is that?
Well, just because it's based on like political considerations, like forcible. I mean, a lot of the time, like, for instance, in national criminal law, it seems like sort of like collapsed. Oftentimes, like, a lot of African countries complain that they're unfairly targeted. But I think in a lot of ways it's because they have less political protection than some other countries. So, like, a national community can actually mount pressure on individuals and have them brought to court. Whereas, like, for instance, a nation like North Korea, I mean, like, they have nuclear deterrence. There's other reasons why they might not be. You know, they have kidnapped Japanese citizens, but like Japan's not going to go to war for North Korea or some kidnapped citizens.
I'm just trying to get the feeling Saudi Arabia's going to come up here at some point in this conversation, in this class.
Yeah.
Not today.
Not today?
I mean, no, it's all over the news today, specifically.
What Saudi now?
So they, apparently CNN got intel that they did murder the reporter who was in the Turkish embassy, Saudi embassy in Turkey. Because it was an interrogation gone wrong.
So oh, really?
Yeah, it's been all over. Whether they did, I mean, they haven't admitted anything, but now, media all over say that they have.
Is that the Turkish video audio recording where they said that they? I think the Turkish government was saying that they had some audio recording of him being murdered.
Yeah, and then now I think the Saudis are kind of realizing that they have nowhere to go, so it's just people don't know obviously if it's true or not, but.
Trump said it could have been rogue killers.
I was going to say, I read that like just before this class. Yeah.
Okay. No, that's fine. That's fine. It sounds suspiciously like the 300-pound man in the New Jersey basement who hacked the internet. But
you don't get unverified people just walking around consulates. But
there's also like photos at the airport of the assassination squad.
They landed and then they.
It's like a known squad, and there's like very clear footage of them passing the security, like their bags and everything.
But there's a video of them going into the embassy and then leaving to Saudi through Dubai. I mean, there's everything.
All on the same day.
Yeah.
Wow.
He went out a back exit where there were no cameras. It just happened to work out that way.
Okay. I'm struggling to think how to convert this into an educational lesson.
Well, it's a good example because, like, in that case, I mean, the Saudi Arabia could get protection from the United States in the sense that Trump's saying it's a rogue killer. I mean, even if you can, there's political considerations in terms of violations of international norms where no pressure will mount. I mean, the Saudis are committing crimes in Yemen, you never really hear about. There's not been any real international recourse for that. There's not
going
to be any real international response to, like, Assad.
Well, okay, let me sort of see if I can offer two baskets here and then just kick them around. Just United States and Turkey and Saudi Arabia. I mean, let's assume, and I think this is a fair statement, as a norm of international law, it could be either customary or by treaty. We'll talk about that in a minute. It is a violation of international law for one sovereign state to assassinate the citizen of another state, extrajudicially and without cause. If that were the circumstance here, first of all, and going back to my question previously, who has a claim against whom? Does the family of the journalist have a claim against Turkey, against Saudi Arabia? Would the United States have a claim? How does this work?
The Saudi citizen who was murdered was a U.S. resident, and
as in a green card resident, like
he worked for the Washington Post.
Okay, so I'm assuming he had some naturalization status of some sort in the United States.
So, and actually, that's one of the issues that people, the media, was asking Trump. You know, even though he's not a citizen as a resident with a green card, he is due some sort of protection by the United States. And the United States, because we're dealing with Saudi being an ally and having a huge business relationship, deciding whether or not they want to cross that line and grant, but to mean to seek the protection of, or the enforcement of the murder of a U.S. resident. So I think trying to bring it to climate change or any climate change related issue, the first issue they would have to tackle is relationships and allies between nations. And I think that would dictate a lot of how countries will act, who will actually seek enforcement or seek punishment or seek any sort of...
Absolutely, but if I could tease the thing that I'm catching from both of your responses, it is solely government to government. The United States can bring a claim. Theoretically, Turkey can bring a claim, although we could talk about to what extent international law norms apply on embassy grounds, because embassies under the Vienna Convention we'll talk about have a special judicial status.
Could it also be a wife or family members?
Well, remember I said two baskets. Yeah. That's the next basket, I'm sorry.
This might be getting into political theory too much, but if you live in a Westphalian system, if you believe in a social contract...
You know, I'm going to have to warn you, I may ask you to define Westphalian for everybody in the room, but we'll wait for that in a minute. And if you could do it without invoking Henry Kissinger, I'll be very impressed. All right.
So if you believe in we are in a Westphalian system. If you believe in the social contract theory, then people, when they live in nation states, they give up some of their rights. They give up a monopoly of power to the nation in order to protect them, but you give up rights to do that. It's a trade system. And so citizens don't have rights against other states. You don't have any rights compared to a citizen in that state, you don't have any rights in compared to that government. So we don't have any, there's no way to bring a claim when you don't have a right to it.
Absolutely.
You give all those rights to your nation state in order to protect you, and you're hoping that the nation state that you're in is going to put your interests before what other interests they have out there.
All right. Subject to an important caveat of the second basket I keep mysteriously referring to. Absolutely. And that's, I think, the key thing to take away from this. Even in an extremely egregious situation, such as alleged to have occurred, this poor Khashoggi, I just can't believe. Anyway, that is a matter of government to government claim. International law is the law of governments, of sovereign states. As a result, even if sovereign conduct has implications for individual citizenry, citizens traditionally, under international law, do not have redress under the international legal system. This government has to bring their claim for them. So in theory, the United States could seek redress from Saudi Arabia if there was some status that Khashoggi had in the United States that made him the ward of the United States for citizenry purposes. I think he's still a citizen in Saudi Arabia, so that kind of complicates things a little bit. So it also depends if the United States wants to. And the United States has clearly expressed concerns that they want to do something, but they want to make sure it's something that is not going to have economically harmful impacts in the United States, so who knows what that conduct might be. You know, we may not cancel arms contracts. We may choose to call back ambassadors. But that's the United States' call. The family has no say. The widow, I'm afraid to say, has no say. I mentioned potentially Turkey is a government that may have a claim. For what it's worth, I'll just simply note in passing, it's not relevant for this class. Under the Vienna Convention, traditionally, consulates and embassies are deemed to be subject solely to the laws, jurisdictions of their host, of the nation from which they originate, the nations that of whom they are the emissaries of. In other words, effectively, Turkish law does not apply inside the fence line of the embassy of Saudi Arabia inside Istanbul. So it does raise an interesting question. If the murder allegedly took place at the behest of the world government and Saudi Arabian law permitted that sort of action, you may have a situation where even Turkey may not have a claim even for this conduct taking place on its soil. That is me rankly speculating. Please put it aside and don't hold me to it later. Second basket, there is an exception to this fundamental norm of international law that it's state to state, namely, developing norms dealing with human rights. Now, those norms apply to individual conduct. We'll talk about those in greater detail, especially in about 4 weeks, when we will talk about essentially what's happening with human rights law and climate change. I will simply say the Giuliani case, to a certain extent, even though it's counted as constitutional, explicitly draws on human rights issues. And an important decision in the Dutch appellate court 2 weeks ago relies on international human rights law to order the Dutch government to reduce greenhouse gas emissions for that nation. So the key thing, human rights law does provide a space for individuals to have redress and individual rights under international legal norms. In that second basket as well is what are called crimes of universal jurisdiction. And those will come up again later when we talk about some domestic laws, but essentially pirates, terrorists, genocide, certain crimes that are deemed to be so heinous that all nations of the earth are empowered to try and convict the individual who conducts them. That notice means that international law is focusing on the individual, not the nation state. And that's one of the rare beachheads where people are subjects of international law. Does that hang together for everybody? Because that's sort of the fundamental difference. International law doesn't deal with people, which sounds odd to say. It's really about the conduct of nation states. It has to be done in such a way that those nation states are all accorded equal sovereign respect. And you don't have a supranational body that can tell them what to do. Now, some of you are probably shaking your heads and saying, wow, he's got that all wrong. What about the United Nations? What about the International Court of Justice? What about the Permanent Court of Arbitration? There are international bodies that can tell nations what to do. I agree, absolutely, with one important distinction. Every one of those bodies require the nation state to consent to their jurisdiction. That's why, for example, the United States has withdrawn mandatory jurisdictional consent for certain classes of cases to the ICJ.
Even if they consent to jurisdiction, it's for those international bodies to enforce their holdings is almost impossible. It's more of a, like what just happened with U.S. and Iran, right? The ICJ held that some of the sanctions were illegal, but then the U.S. can be okay. Well, thank you, but we're not going to listen to you.
That's very interesting. Next. Yeah. Absolutely. And I don't mean to diminish. The ICJ plays a very important role in informing international law. We'll talk about that in a second, too. But enforcement depends on other mechanisms, typically. So the UN can pass trade sanctions. That the security, but the Security Council theoretically can employ military force. But that's been extraordinarily rare. So when we're talking about international law, we're talking about the way nations deal with each other in such a way that they are acting as surrogates for the interest of their citizens, but the citizens don't necessarily have a direct say. So with that in mind, and unfortunately the reading is focused on U.S. law, but I want to make sure we're on the same page. Where does international law come from? What are its sources? And here we can cheat a little bit because we've already talked about some of them. The number one place that it typically tends to come from is treaties. By the way, I don't want to say I'm just making this up. This is all from a particular treaty that created the International Court of Justice. And that treaty spells out where the sources of international law come from. So this is an authoritative source in terms of where you look to find out what an international legal principle is. So number one is treaties. And notice I use the plural. There's no one supranational treaty that defines what international law is. What you're really doing is looking at what tends to be either bilateral treaties in series or a multilateral treaty, and use that to essentially see developing norms as embodied and binding legal obligations nation to nation. A few things I'll throw out there. You know, what is a treaty? That's a tricky question, isn't it? We all know what it, you know, a traditional treaty looks like, but suppose President Trump sends a letter to the government of Belgium saying that they are going to respect wedding registrations in a way so that if someone registers domestic partnership, it counts as a marriage in the United States. Is that a treaty? Why not?
I mean, it depends how he submitted it. It's usually, I mean...
Not treaty for U.S. law, treaty for international law purposes.
What's a commitment? Isn't it because if it's President Trump who made that commitment, then you can say that it's the U.S. as a whole because he's a representative of a country. But it's not treaty standing because, it, or at least in the U.S. context, for it to have a treaty, the Senate has to approve and then it becomes official. So it's a process that has to be followed, not just, you know, sign it.
Now, you've captured the slippery thing at the heart of it all. You can have an agreement which functions and effectively is the equivalent of a treaty for international law purposes, but is not a treaty for purposes of Senate ratification and two-thirds approval. Sorry, is it two? It's two-thirds. I can't believe I blanked on that for a second. So bottom line there is a treaty essentially is an instrument. It doesn't have to be called a treaty, but if it functions in terms of imposing legal obligations on each of the partners in a reciprocal way, that is functionally a treaty for international legal purposes. The key thing is that it has a concept associated with it, which is the Latin is pacta sunt servanda, that the treaty must be implemented in a way in good faith that the parties accomplish the respective intentions of each other's consent. You know, you basically honor a treaty. And that honor goes not just to the letter of the treaty, but also to the goals of the treaty. All this is embodied in a treaty on treaties called the Vienna Convention on Treaties. And that will pop up as we talk a little bit later in the semester about particularly the way the Paris Agreement actually operates. Okay, so that's number one. There are a couple of others you need to have in your pocket. And I just want to make sure we're clear on the fact that save me from waving my hands a lot. Sources of international law. Maria and Chris also rightly pointed out earlier, that's not necessarily where the bulk of international law comes from. And here the reading from Professor Hinken comes into play. What's essentially the common law of international law? Customary international law. What is that?
So it has two elements, which is actual acceptance of a state for a number of states or countries, and actual forgetting the second element, recognition and action for.
So practice and acceptance.
Yeah.
But it's more than that. You have to have a magic secret sauce. essentially, if everybody is doing the same thing, but they're all doing it for independent reasons of convenience and circumstance, what you need is a sense, and I'm sorry, Maria, I was talking over you.
Sorry, I spoke over you. You do it because you acknowledge it as a something that you owe to the other nation, not just to yourself, right? Or other nations have to do it out of that sense of obligation.
Right, obligation. That's the key word, legal obligation, which in Latin, and this is one where, unfortunately, the jargon matters because this is one that will come up, whoever you talk to in climate change international law, opinio iuris. The idea that you're doing it not because you choose to, but because the power of law compels that course of conduct. So customary law is not written anywhere. Customary law arises and changes and shifts and evolves, and as a result, there's no finish line. You can have common law, I'm sorry, I fight blending those two. You can have customary legal norms that essentially predate the United States, and that they are essentially the existing framework we inherited at the creation of the United States. However, because it is dependent on the conduct of nations, and because it depends on essentially this binding sense of opinio iuris, there are some quirks about customary international law. One is, treaties can influence customary international law. So essentially, if you have a customary international law norm, slavery is just fine. But nations decide they don't like that norm anymore, they can sign a treaty that would alter that customary international norm. So it's not essentially one controls the other, but they definitely can influence each other. Number two, nations can opt out of customary international law in a limited fashion. If a customary norm is crystallizing and a nation feels that it's got it wrong in respect to something that applies to its conduct, it can voice its disbelief, its refusal to assent to that emerging norm, and more importantly, take action that reflects its failure to consent, its refusal to consent. And as a result of that, it is not deemed to be held to that customary international norm as it regards to its conduct. As always, there are some exceptions. But for example, there is an important bay near Tripoli where Libya was claiming that it was actually national waters and that therefore they could do anything they wanted to, including mining it. The United States felt that under international norms, it was actually an international body of water that had a right of innocent passage in. So while Libya was campaigning to have a new international customary norm to protect that bay as a national water, the United States sent warships in solely for the purpose to prevent the creation of that customary international norm. So there's some way nations can, I say opt out, that's a bit of a strong term, but they can shape the crystallization creation of international norms that apply to them, but they have to do it while it's being formed, they have to take express action to show that they're not being agreeing to be bound by its formation. Does that make sense for everybody? Those customary norms are extremely important. We're going to talk about them because, just to keep your interest piqued here, they are U.S. law. They're enforced by U.S. courts. So this is an important issue for our class. The third one is general international legal principles. That sounds vague and amorphous because it is. Essentially, these are fundamental foundational principles that aren't really captured by either of these, but they're nonetheless part of the bedrock of international law. For example, there are some principles that are deemed to be so important. I heard you whisper. Can you say what Jus Cogens is?
I mean, in our class, they just talk about the law because they're so recognized in the as
violation of Jus Cogens because it's just so widely recognized.